TikTok started last year around the fact that we know that centers are doing just absolutely amazing things. And when we get the applications in terms of the Golden Light Bulb and the Golden Abacus, there are so many centers who are really deserving of those awards, and we can only award one every year. So we've done things like posters in the past and all of that, but this time we decided that we really wanted to get centers to have the opportunity to explain what all they are doing. I will let folks introduce themselves as they come up here, and then they will go into their TED Talks. We can save time for questions towards the end. If there's anybody else who would like to get up and talk about a program after we do our formalized ones, I would love to hear you come up here and talk. So we are going to start with Health Solutions and then just go from there, please.
Okay, so I'm going to start out by saying that throughout modern history, innovative teams in large vehicles have been making a difference in the world. Perhaps you remember the work of these folks, maybe these folks. And I'm here today to tell you about how a team of four, equipped with this large vehicle, are making a difference in Pueblo through early intervention and prevention efforts. My name is Katie Ledbetter, and I'm a therapist for the Mobile Early Intervention Services team for Health Solutions, formerly Spanish Peaks Behavioral Health Care. We're the community mental health provider for Pueblo, Los Animas, and Huerfano counties. In the last year, I've had the pleasure of collaborating to further develop and implement this specialized team with the goal of identifying and connecting with at-risk populations in hopes of preventing mental health crises whenever possible. We've done this through a combination of strategic relationship building, targeted community outreach, and also by making ourselves a valuable and visible presence in our community. We all understand the wisdom that says an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If you're anything like me, you've probably been highly disappointed to see that in general, our systems of care don't really reflect this knowledge. In fact, just this week before coming here, I conducted outreach with a 68-year-old man who lived about 10 miles outside of the city limits, really kind of out in the middle of nowhere. This individual had several mental health diagnoses and also a hearing impairment. He relied exclusively on a caretaker for administration of daily medications and to ensure that he was scheduling and attending necessary appointments. When visiting with him, I learned that his caretaker had recently died, and I immediately was concerned that he wouldn't be able to meet his basic needs in the absence of this caretaker and that he wouldn't be able to seek out a new one. So I made a phone call to a community support agency, explained my concerns, and my hope that they might be able to step in and make sure that this individual doesn't fall through the cracks and doesn't reach a crisis point. Unfortunately, the response I received was, "We don't do prevention. Give us a call if something happens, and we'll step in and help." As unfortunate as that response is, everybody's nodding because everybody knows that that's not uncommon. The Mobile Early Intervention Services team was developed in part to inject the wisdom of early intervention and prevention into what we're doing in community mental health. There are a number of factors that we were responding to when visioning this team. For instance, we know that a large number of individuals leaving our local emergency rooms that have a behavioral health diagnosis have never been seen by our agency, which tells us that a large number of people in our community are reaching their breaking point before we reach them. We also know that a lot of individuals still receive psychiatric medications from their primary care doctors, even though we know that the best outcomes for lots of mental health conditions come from a combination of medication and formal treatment interventions like talk therapy. We know through our cooperation with the crisis intervention team of the Pueblo Police Department that a very large number of mental health issues are falling into the hands of law enforcement, individuals who are tasked with ensuring public safety, and those who are not expected to be mental health experts. We also know that a large number of individuals struggling with mental health conditions don't understand those conditions. And what's worse, they have no idea that there are services and supports out there that can help them. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the details of our team, just to show that we were thinking about all of these factors and others as we move forward. So the team operates out of a small RV that's been outfitted as a fully functional mobile office. Everything we need to provide services is right there. And so this allows us to maximize our flexibility and our responsiveness. It allows us to be where issues arise, when they arise. And this mobility has allowed us to hone our response time to less than 3 hours for 90% of our referral requests. The team also operates from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday. This spread of availability is a very clear recognition that destabilizing events, overwhelming events, those things don't always come up during business hours on weekdays, right? The team is staffed in two partnerships. Each partnership works three 12-hour shifts a week. Each partnership is comprised of a licensed therapist and a case manager. This staffing reflects our understanding of the multi-layered and complex factors that often push somebody toward the brink of a mental health crisis. So as a clinician on the team, I'm able to respond to some of those issues around medications and changes in symptoms, while my case manager partner is able to respond to the very real threats to basic needs that very often push people to their breaking point. Excuse me. We also offer a range of availability. We're available on a referral basis as well as on call. Again, this reflects our understanding that individuals, entities in our community, which I'll talk about in a minute, may come into contact with someone and they may see a warning sign and they can reach out, make a referral to us, and we can jump in and try to intervene before it escalates to a crisis. We also know that sometimes individuals find themselves on the edge with what feels like no warning at all. So we want to be able to respond instantly when needed and be able to respond in a planned manner when that's necessary. So I'd like to tell you a story about one of our very first cases that I think really illustrates the reach and the capacity of this team. Early last fall, a call was routed to our outpatient services director. This call was from a concerned family member who had a brother in the Pueblo community. He explained that his brother had struggled with mental illness throughout his life and had recently fallen out of contact with his family members who were all out of town. The caller had information that led him to believe that his brother might be facing a possible eviction, and he was desperately hopeful that Health Solutions would be able to step in and do something to intervene in this potential crisis situation. The director passed this information on to my team and we took action. So we started trying to reach him by phone, and when that was unsuccessful, we drove our office to his house. We knocked on his door a number of times before he finally answered one evening. He was definitely confused and a little bit suspicious of our presence on his doorstep, but we explained that his family members were concerned about him and that we were there to help in any way we could. At this point, our potential client broke down a little bit. He explained that he was, in fact, severely depressed, that his companion, his dog, had recently died. He'd been without psychiatric medications for an extended period, and he was facing an eviction. Even in spite of all of these admissions, he wasn't quite yet receptive to the information we were providing about how services could really help him get back on track. So we left our contact information and we agreed to come back a week later to continue this conversation, continue encouraging him. Over the next month, we visited him with about 15 different times. And eventually, he decided he was willing to become a client. And let me back up, sorry, for just a moment and say that in the span of that month, one of the wonderful things that happened was I, as a clinician, was able to monitor him for any decompensation, deterioration in his condition, and to make sure I was paying attention to any signs that he might need a higher level of care right away. At the same time, my case manager partner was able to talk with this individual about his housing needs and threats to his other basic needs, talk to him about how case management services could also help him address these issues in his life. So when he was ready to become a client, he was still expressing some hesitancy about getting into the office. His symptoms were really, really high, and he was just really struggling. So we completed his intake assessment in our mobile office, and we set up an appointment, his first appointment, in a physical location, and a case manager from my team accompanied him to make sure that we could facilitate a warm handoff of sorts, and so that this person would feel anchored as he took this next important step. A year later, I'm happy to tell you that he obtained stable housing, and he's still engaged in treatment. In the first year of our work, we've encountered 350 individuals just like this man. And while not every story has an ending like this one, a lot of them do, and we're really proud of that. I'd like to tell you a little bit more about some of our strategies for reaching at-risk populations this year. these strategies have fallen into these three categories here. So I'm going to talk a bit about relationship building, starting with the work that we've done to ensure that we are a valuable and accessible resource to our own staff members. So we work hard because we know that caseloads are high and demand is even higher than that. So we're a resource to the staff at Health Solutions when they're working with clients and they have a concern about a possible crisis. Our work in cooperation with Health Solutions staff takes a number of forms, but often we're doing things like reaching out to a client who's stopped attending treatment, reach out, trying to bring that person back into the fold of care before they reach a crisis point and something more intensive is necessary. Sometimes a provider notices a warning sign or a red flag, and we're able to reach out and monitor that client, again, for any changes or any immediate needs. I'm sure you can imagine that there are multitudes of situations in which it would be very valuable to have a team at the ready to jump and respond in a situation where a client might be at risk. Our efforts on relationship building have also centered around creating strategic partnerships in our community. In the past year, we've successfully partnered with a very wide range of agencies and organizations, including the Rape Crisis Center of Pueblo, Department of Social Services and Adult Protective Services, the Homeless Health Clinic, as well as the homeless shelters, Catholic Charities, even the library. Most of the time, our work with these outside entities comes in the form of picking up where a mental health referral leaves off. So an individual who may be at risk comes into contact with some community entity, they recognize a need for mental health care, and they make that referral. Most of us probably know that there are a few people who would take that referral and run with it. They would get set up, they'd get the services they need, and that'd be that. We also know that individuals who are on the edge of a crisis often are not internally or externally resourced enough to take those necessary steps. And that's where my team comes in. We're able to be informed of those referrals and then connect to that individual and make sure that we monitor and support them through every step of the enrollment process, ensuring that they're not falling through the cracks and that they are getting the care that they need. One of the most critical community relationships that we've cultivated this year has been with law enforcement. If you don't know, Pueblo, Colorado has the highest crime rate in the state, and it's among the highest rates in the nation. There is no shortage of work for our officers and deputies in Pueblo. In the past year, my team has responded to 60 law enforcement requests, including 20 in the month of September alone. We can definitely see that there's been a huge increase in the demand for our assistance with law enforcement. And in this way, we noticed that we can do a couple of things to assist our law enforcement partners. We can respond on scene when additional direction is needed, and we also follow up with crisis intervention team reports. And if that's something you're not familiar with, crisis intervention team in the police department is made up of officers who've had specialized training, helps them to recognize and appropriately respond to mental health issues as they come up in their work. So when officers respond to an incident that they believe mental illness is a factor, if we're not called to the scene directly, we receive a report and we follow up immediately to ensure that that individual is linked to necessary mental health care. When we're responding on scene, we're a valuable resource for law enforcement officers. It can certainly be difficult, even for those of us in the field, to know exactly what someone on the verge of a mental health crisis needs. And it seems a stretch at best and inappropriate at worst to expect that our law enforcement officers are going to know the difference between somebody who needs safety planning and some brief counseling versus someone who really needs crisis level care. And again, that's where my team steps in. By intervening, responding on scene, we're able to cut down on unnecessary emergency room trips and crisis evaluations, and importantly, we're then able to free up law enforcement resources for our community. There was a call a few weeks ago that I thought was important to share, and that is came from the Sheriff's Department asking us to respond with a severely depressed individual, and we showed up on scene, talked with the gentleman a bit, and he eventually admitted that he just called the Sheriff's Department because he really needed someone to talk to. In that moment, my team was able to link him to peer support services so that he had an accessible and appropriate resource available to him anytime he just needed to talk. One of the other things we've done is targeted community outreach. And these are instances where we know there's a need and we can take action to fill that need directly. So an example of this came from our knowledge that a large number of individuals who have diabetes and are on dialysis also have depressive disorders. So with this knowledge, we reached out to the dialysis clinics in our community and set up times to be on site providing information, brief counseling, support for enrollment, trying to make sure to catch some of those folks who might otherwise fall through the cracks. Another example of this targeted community outreach came in the aftermath of a tragic teen suicide last year in our community. My team responded by developing a 90-minute teen suicide awareness and prevention workshop, which we then facilitated at that school to aid in that recovery process. The last thing up here is becoming a presence. So we've worked really hard to just become a visible and valuable presence in our community. And that's taken the form of attending a very wide range of community events to just be out there with our community. So we've done things like participate in Take Back the Night for Colorado State University Pueblo, all the way over to attending, having a booth at the Wild West Festival that happened to fall during Mental Health Awareness Month. So these opportunities are really have been very, very important for my team because it's a chance to talk to our community. And even more importantly, as I'm sure you can imagine, it's an opportunity to listen, to hear what they have to say, what kinds of questions people have about mental health. Most of you probably know that everyone still thinks mental health services are just for crazy people, right? So it's a fantastic opportunity to say, no, 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 it can be for you too, and let me tell you how and why. So I'll tell you that in the first year, it's definitely been a lot of learning, a lot of growth, and we're looking forward to that continuing as we move forward. We really do believe that we have a responsibility to our community to use our knowledge and expertise to get in front of these issues that challenge and threaten the well-being and the health of our friends, our neighbors, and our community members. And while I don't expect that you're all going to leave here today determined to get an RV and hit the road, I do hope that you will be thinking a bit about how we can all mobilize our knowledge and connect with the agencies and organizations in our communities to be innovative and to push toward using that wisdom of prevention more and more. Thank you.
So hello, I'm Mandy Keisner. I'm with Solvista Health. And I'm really honored to be here today to talk about one of the innovative practices that we've used over at Solvista Health in order to improve our emergency services systems for our community. And our innovative practice was basically to hire AMR ambulance transportation to transport our clients who needed a higher level of care. And why I want to say that this is actually a very humane way to transport people is before that, we actually only had the ability to contact law enforcement in these situations to be able to transport people. So it's really about fostering humanity in that transportation system. So it may just sound like transportation, but really it's meaning way more for our community and for the clients that we serve. I also want to emphasize that how we came up with this solution is because we continue to strive to seek humanity in what often seems like a very inhumane practice and world, right? Emergency services are not perfect. There are still so many gaps. And so we strive to be better, and I really believe that innovation comes out of that. I firmly believe that humanity fosters innovation. So when I first moved to Colorado, a little over 10 years ago, I moved here from Chicago. It was kind of quite the culture shift anyway. But so I moved to over the hill. So Solvista Health is basically over the hill from here where we're at this conference. And it's basically nestled all along the Arkansas River Valley, surrounded by this beautiful, gorgeous bowl full of mountains, right? And so I moved there and I think to myself, oh my gosh, this place is so beautiful. How could anyone ever have a mental health emergency, right? I mean, this job is going to be the easiest job I've ever had, and nobody's going to need help, right? And so then day two happens, and I soon realized that not only do people need help, but they're actually, you know, biking, hitchhiking, busing here to have their mental health emergencies is what it feels like to me at times. And so, you know, day two, I also realized that this is the Wild West. I've been dropped in the middle of this Wild West adventure right now. And I'll share an example with you of this my Wild West adventure here. So they invite me to go to this emergency services council meeting. An emergency services council is basically, it's like your law enforcement, your ambulance, your search and rescue. Anybody who deals with community shenanigans basically is at this event. And so they invite me to this event for the first time, and they explain how to get there. And they explain how to get there is basically the building is on the left side of what's the community, the county waste facility, right? You got to go down this winding road. You turn into the waste facility and you go down this winding road. But what they fail to tell me is that on the other side of the building is actually the gun club shooting range. And so realize, people, I'm from Chicago. When I hear gunfire, I like drop to the floor, right? Or I run because like it's a survival skill. And so you can imagine my surprise as I step out of my vehicle and I hear gunfire. And it's not just gunfire, it's like pop, 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 you know, it's like major gunfire. I immediately like drop my bag and I just run like a cheetah toward this emergency services building, and I bust in the building and I'm probably like screaming something inaudible like, they're under attack, you know. So I make this horrible first impression on these people, but that's when I really realized that this is, you know, the Wild West. And this is what I'm now doing. So day three of my Wild West adventure, I also realized that we are really short of resources that we need. I realized that we don't have things like a psychiatric ER, right? So I asked my coworker, I say, you know, I really need to get this person hospitalized. I really need to get to a higher level of care. And she, I asked her specifically, I said, so where are our beds? You know, and who do we have connections with in order to get this person placed? And she looks at me, and she's laughing at me, of course. And she's like, no, we don't have any beds, Mandy. Like, you're from the city. Like, this isn't happening here. And she's like, and the other thing, too, is we don't have any of these special connections you're referring to. And she accuses my Chicago-ness, right, of wanting to have these special connections with people. That it's just something about that culture that I'm coming from. But so you get the picture, right? So the nearest psychiatric, we don't have a psych ER, and the nearest psychiatric facility is about 2.5 to 3 hours away. So when you're talking about, and back to the innovative practice, when you're talking about the beauty of hiring AMR ambulance transportation instead of having police transport, realize that we're talking about a 2.5 to 3 hour trip in the back of a police car. Not a good solution, not what you want to see anyone go through. Because what sort of message is that sending, right? Mental illness is not a crime. So we all work very hard to emphasize this, but imagine being the person in crisis, desperately needing help, and then being put in the back of a police car in order to get the care that they need. So I want to paint this picture because it's not just a transportation service that we've created here. It's about establishing and creating humanity in what's often a very inhumane process and system. So we're all dealt our cards, right? And in mental health, we're often dealt a hand that basically doesn't give us all the resources we need. And in fact, it also, you know, maybe the resources that we're given aren't even enough, right? So what we did at Sol Vista, we used our desire to create and foster humanity to not accept the hand that we were given. So what we fought to do was to see what other alternatives might be possible in spite of the hand that we're given. Because the reality is the hand that we were dealt was not in line with the values that we have as a mental health center, right? It's not in line with the value of humanity, kindness, respect, dignity that we try to give people. The message that we want to send is that mental illness is not a crime, right? And that we are the place to go to in your darkest hour. So what I've learned from all the years of doing emergency work is that no matter how big the crisis situation is that people are ultimately human. And I know this fact is obvious, but I really want to emphasize that because sometimes I really think that we sometimes look at the person as the disorder. And when we do that, I think that we lose our sense of humanity. And I know that clients can sense this when we look at them as their disorder and not them as a person. And I think that that's where we lose engagement with clients. So we strive each day to see the person across from us as having needs, a family. They've got their own desires, wants, goals, right? Because we too have experienced emotional loss. And we too have experienced emotional instability. And who in this room hasn't been in so deep in the depths of grief that you couldn't possibly imagine a way out? So I'm very humbled by the team that I serve for their ability to create humanity and what really happens in the most unique situations out there in rural community mental health in my Wild West. Because I really believe that humanity, again, fosters innovation. And in rural community mental health, I see innovation happen every day. Our clients often joke that we should be like one of those reality TV shows, and sometimes I think I agree with them. Because it's unbelievable to me at the level we go to for, you know, to help people who are in our building or in our parking lot to get them the care that they need. But all joking aside, when we create humanity and set up our emergency response to foster genuine relationships with people who are experiencing crisis, we set up the kind of environment that people actually want to come to. So the story I want to share with you today is a story that happened a few years back with me. And I want to share a story that happened a few years back because this is when we didn't have that relationship with AMR, right? This is when we had to use the police, you know, transportation system to get people to safety. But long story short, we had an adult male who was probably in his early 20s who was experiencing likely his second psychotic episode. And our team had been working with him for about 5 days. Because again, in a situation where you know, really don't have a psychiatric, immediate access to a psychiatric facility, you have to use law enforcement, you go to every measure you can to avoid hospitalization, right? So we've been working with him for about 5 days, trying to keep him safe in the community and get him back on his medications, that which we will refer to as Plan A. And then about day 5, we soon realized that we're moving from Plan A and into Plan B, which is that this gentleman really did need psychiatric care. He was telling me that he was not safe. And I was also realizing, our team was realizing that he wasn't safe. So what I want to emphasize is that we don't do this to him. We actively involve him in every step and part of this process that we're doing, okay? So I'm in the room with this young man. I'm having this open and honest conversation with him that, you know, we're really concerned about him and things aren't getting better. And you know, again, he's also saying that he's not safe and he doesn't feel safe in the community. So we're having this open and honest conversation. And again, I'm having this conversation directly with him, not behind his back and not with his family members outside of his, you know, earshot. We have this discussion with him as an equal human being, right? Because we realize that he has a unique personality and self outside of his mental health symptoms. And although the symptoms of his mental health have become severe, and most of his thoughts are not in reality, I'm still speaking to him, the person outside of the mental illness. Because when we fail to remember that a mental illness is not all of, it's not all of a person, right? It's just part of someone. And we treat someone like it's all of them, we fail to give them humanity. And you say, yes, Mandy, this is all beautiful, wonderful, unicorns, rainbows, right? And this is something that we strive to do every day of our lives. And you know, what happens next? So basically, I recognize his fear, because I'm sitting in the room with him, we're having this conversation, and he gets so afraid. He knows what's about to happen, right? And the human in me sees the human in him, and I see that he's afraid. And so what I do is I said, you know, I can see that you're afraid. Would you like to take a, you know, walk outside and get some air and continue to talk about this? And all you dark side of the moon type people in the room are probably saying that's the worst choice you could ever make, right? Because you're going to take a risk. This is what's going to happen. He's going to run, right? But I want to take this risk because I want to offer him humanity, right? Because I see how afraid he is. And that doesn't feel good to me, because it doesn't feel like what we've been trying to do for the last 5 days. And so we walk outside, and I go to try to say something inspirational, he's not there. He does run. So that happens, yeah. So he actually, he doesn't run to the open side of the parking lot. He actually runs to the other side of the parking lot, which is the back of an auto sales building, where at the time had an 11-foot fence. And so you can imagine, I'm super anxious, because I can just imagine my team, because I'm the supervisor at this point, right? And they're all probably standing there and looking out at me, going, oh man, she's blowing it here. This is not good. And so at this point, he runs to the fence, and I'm thinking, oh, this is good. You know, he might change his mind. He stops. He's changing his mind. No, he doesn't change his mind. He actually climbs the 11-foot fence. And so at this point, too, I'm in the corner of this parking lot, and I'm just standing there completely dumbfounded and amazed. I mean, I'm actually amazed at the physical agility that this man has climbed this fence, right? And he actually, at the time, because I've talked to him since then, he actually thought I was going to climb that fence. But I'm just standing there just in disbelief of what's happened, right? And so he gets over on the other side of the fence, and he doesn't keep running. He stops, and he turns around. And so now I'm standing there at the edge of the parking lot, right? And we start having this moment where it's like nobody says anything, and it feels like this eternity, right? But it's probably more like a few minutes. And so we're just staring at each other like beaming thoughts across this fence and, having sort of this moment. And the reality is that the part of me on my side of the fence, the truth of the matter is, I saw him across the fence, and I was rooting for him. I was saying, my heart was saying, run, go, run, don't stop. And of course I'm going to come find you, because I care about your health and your well-being, but for right now, run. And the reason I was, doing that is because we both knew where we were headed, right? We both knew the road that we were going down. So, and the reality is he needed hospitalization. And in the rural areas, it takes us about 24 to 48 hours to secure placement. And they're not sitting in a psych ER where they're starting to get treatment. They're sitting in a medical ER just waiting for placement. And at which point we finally do secure placement, they get placed in the back of a police car and transported 3 hours away in handcuffs. So that was our reality, and we both knew it. So back to the fence, and again, what happens to be like this eternity of staring at each other. I bet you all wonder what happened, right? So what happens is a miracle. What happens is he actually climbs back over that fence. And what happens is we walk back into the building together. And what happens is we do sit for 24 hours waiting for psychiatric placement. And what happens is we do walk out together in the hospital parking lot. And I watch with his family, seeing him put in the back of a police car to be transported 3 miles away, or 3 hours away. But what also happens is this young man gets the help that he needs. And so the whole time, throughout what seems like the most inhumane process, we strive and we work to provide him with humanity, dignity, and respect. Now flip forward to the future. This man's doing great. Again, he got the care that he needs. He still checks in with me here and there, and actually we joke quite frequently about this fence moment that we had, that we shared together when we bonded. So I ask him after he comes back to the hospital, I was like, why on earth did you climb back over that fence? And I want to read to you what he said to me. He says, I knew that I was not all right in my mind, but you guys always care about me. You always treated me with respect, even when I wasn't all right. He climbed back over that fence because we gave him humanity, dignity, and respect. So here's my challenge to all of you and myself every day. We always need to strive to create and foster humanity in spite of the resources that we're given, right? So it is in the spirit that we kept trying to secure a better transport system for people And we established that relationship with AMR Ambulance Service to transport people when they needed a higher level of care. So now when they need a higher level of care, they go in style. They go with professionals who care about them, who don't treat them like criminals, right? But like human beings. So in closing, the reality is that the state of our emergency services is not where it needs to be. It's not perfect. The reality is we're chronically underfunded, and the resources just aren't there, and a lot of things need attention. And I would also say that rural community mental health needs some resources and support. But all that being said, we foster our environments. And so no matter what the odds, even with no resources, we can still foster humanity in our emergency response services. Because when we do that, we create safe and welcoming places that foster innovative practices. Practices like hiring an ambulance service instead of police. Practices like hiring peers who have actively experienced a crisis, who can sit with somebody who's actively in one. It's the spirit of humanity that has a local women's group sewing homemade pillowcases and recycling hotel toiletries so that when people do have to go to the hospital and go to some place that's not their own, they get to take something with them that is. So in spite of limited resources and not knowing what the future brings, humanity is something we can offer people now. Humanity is trauma-informed. When we foster this environment, innovation will come. And when we do this, we create environments that people don't run from, but they run to, right? And so I challenge everyone in this room to look at how we can create more humanity in the emergency services that we deliver, because when we do that, people in crisis will not only just show up, they'll climb fences for it. Thank you.
So I want to just give another round of applause for both of these speakers, because you guys are both incredible speakers and really carried that off quite well. So I, again, just... we're going to have some time to ask them questions, and I'm going to ask again if, with this robust mental health group, if anybody is brave enough to come up after these questions to talk a little bit about their own sort of spur of the moment. But we're going to start with the questions, and then if there's any takers, I would love to hear them. So if you guys both want to just stand up here, and if you guys could also repeat the question since we are recording it.
So are there questions that you need to support?
So when it comes to internal referrals, we definitely have a conversation with the treatment team first, so we get some information about any potential risks. Law enforcement, obviously they're securing the scene for us first, so it takes a little bit of digging and a little investigation, and it's another part of the reason that we work in pairs, and we do some of the, we've done some training around just sort of typical safety, the kind of safety measures that any kind of in-home therapy services are using, just that awareness, kind of where you park, those kinds of things. So we're taking those general safety measures, also doing any kind of background, looking for background information before we go out if we can. And when in doubt, we don't, or we ask for assistance from law enforcement. So we make sure to be very careful about that. I'm sorry, I didn't repeat the question. It was, how do we make sure that we protect our personal safety when we're going out into the community? It's a great question. Do we bring them into the van or go inside? It's both. The van is a really wonderful thing because we have that opportunity to bring them in there and meet with clients. I would say maybe 30% of the time, for one reason or another, somebody's more comfortable or it feels more appropriate to meet with them in our vehicle. And then the rest of the time we're and sometimes just in the community as well. We did an intake in a Burger King parking lot once. So just kind of wherever we can be.
Okay, so our next TED Talk is from Aspen Point, and she's been practicing this a very long time, so we're really looking forward to it.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay,
so this is very spontaneous. I'm a board member at Aspen Point. My name is Jane. I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist. But I'm up here to fill in the time, but to also talk from a family's perspective. I know this whole conference is a lot about integrative care, and I can share a story from a family's perspective about care that wasn't integrated and care that's moving into integration. Okay? So I have a son, Luke, who's 31 years old, and he is disabled. He has developmental issues, autism spectrum. He has serious mental health issues. He has a very serious body dysmorphic disorder and an eating disorder and serious anxiety and a whole array of things that go along with all that. He also has ulcerative colitis, and he is a very fragile type 1 diabetic. So I consider him pervasively disabled. But it wasn't always so. The Asperger's, of course, went undiagnosed. It wasn't a recognized diagnosis until he was 10 in the United States. He wasn't diagnosed until he was out of high school. So he has a lot of trauma, a lot of bullying, which is where I think some of the psych stuff comes from. But then he also developed ulcerative colitis from a medication he was on. He was on prednisone to get that under control and developed steroid-induced type 1 diabetes. And after those all came on board, he fell completely off the cliff. And he was in and out of hospitals, in and out of treatment facilities, in and out of residential treatment. And we as a family were completely devastated and could not get any type of integrative care at all. It was very piecemealed. If they did work, the endocrinologist didn't know how to deal with autism. Developmental people had no idea about the psych issues and whatnot. Luke eventually ended up in a group home in Colorado Springs and laid in bed for 2 years. Was absolutely depressed. He was told when to eat, when to take his meds. He had no sense of autonomy. He went back into an RTC, and they wanted him in a nursing home. They said he cannot take care of his diabetes, and he's going to die. And we said, no, he's 24, he's 25 at this point. And he said, you put me in a nursing home, I'll kill myself. And so we started on a journey to try to figure this out on our own. And that process was very hard and very daunting. We bought a cottage in downtown Colorado Springs. We moved Luke into the cottage, and we were providing care 24 hours a day almost until we fell apart, completely fell apart. And the state approached us. At this point now, Luke has SSI. Unbeknownst to us, you know, a care manager at some point said, we think you should apply for SSI. And we're like, well, he's not that disabled. I mean, so as a family, we were in denial. We couldn't see it. We just had to work harder. So he has SSI, and he has Medicaid. He also has a primary insurance too, but we couldn't keep him safe and stable in this cottage. So the state approached us and suggested we look into a program called CDAS, Consumer Directed Attendant Support Services, where Luke was having an RN show up once a day to help him with diabetes. But of course, it was at her schedule, at her time, and they'd wake him up and da da da, and he'd lost all sense of autonomy. So CDAS is consumer-directed care. We'd never heard of it. We didn't know anything about it. We were just like trying to keep him alive. But CDAS is really kind of where care is going in the sense of in-home care. And so we hired our own caregivers. We trained them with Luke's help. We said, Luke, when do you want somebody over here? What do you need from them? Luke was given an allocation based on his needs, and we are now his legal guardians, his dad and I, and so we manage that allocation, and we directed the care and trained it, and Luke had a huge, huge input and stake in that. So now he's in this little cottage. He's living with his dog. He has caregiving that comes to him, and we are working day and night to integrate all his other care. Which we have done. We've got a treatment team together. They don't talk with each other as much as we would like, but I'm the advocate and I talk for him. His dad has now retired and takes over Luke's care full time. And there's no better caregiver than a family member that loves a son. And Luke is stable. He's had one hospitalization in 5 years, which was a couple weeks ago for high blood sugar. But he's done very, very well. I believe integrative care also has to be part of housing. Housing has to be part of it. It has to be part of vocational. He has to have some sense of purpose. As a family, one of the things that helped us more than anything was NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. My husband and I are now family-to-family facilitators. We've taught that class for about 5 or 6 years. We are getting ready to start teaching a military version of it called Homefront. My husband's retired military. The NAMI folks get it. You know, if you haven't heard of family-to-family, go onto their website and check it out. It's a 12-week class, free of charge to anybody that has a loved one with serious mental illness. And it's educational, it's supportive, it's advocacy, and it really took us from being completely traumatized to being more empowered so we could advocate. I did get on the Aspen Point board, kind of representing the consumer, but really to advocate for more integrative care, which is where they're heading, 100 miles an hour. And I'm on another nonprofit board I guess there's two reasons. One is to network constantly for resources for Luke, but the other is to support other people that are in this journey. So I want to say to all of you guys today, your work is key. It is so important. I think this is all going in the right direction. Luke wouldn't be alive if we hadn't figured out how to bring everybody to the table. He wouldn't be. And integrative care is not just psych and medical. It's housing and vocational, and it's everything that we need to live a healthy, empowered life. Thank you.
So I want to thank Jane very much for being so spur of the moment and for giving a very uplifting speech as well. Anybody have any questions of Jane?
The CDAS group? Okay, so that's consumer-directed attendant support services. And Luke has a Medicaid waiver, the EOB, Elderly Blind and Disabled Waiver. He qualifies for a lot of different waivers, but under that waiver comes consumer-directed care. Not every waiver has that on it, but that one does, thank goodness, and that's the one that he qualified for. It's cheaper to provide care for Luke in his home than to put him in assisted living. And so I'm involved in a lot of other things really advocating for that, because that's a win-win. It's a win for the state, they save money. It's a win for him, because he can direct his care, or we can help direct it. Yeah, so they refer to it as CDAS, but it's all consumer-directed care.
And thanks for not embarrassing me for doing an open mic, and it's kind of dangerous to do that, so, it was good. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Any other questions for Jane? Okay, well, we are done with the TED Talks then. We will have more coming up in the next session on the Golden Abacus, and I hope you all come back and just enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.